The Guardian.
I'm Sarah Crown and welcome to our first Edinburgh International Book Festival podcast. We're here in Charlotte Square Gardens and it's a beautiful sunny day, and I'm joined today by Andrew Motion and Frank Cottrell-Boyce. We're here to talk about their book Silver and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang Rides Again. So Andrew and Frank, first of all, thanks very much for being our first guests.
It's a pleasure. At
the festival. Treasure Island and the world of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang are sort of central imaginative spaces for children. For so many of us, in fact, you know, we all lived through these places as kids, and I wondered what the challenges were of going back into places like that.
Well, it took me 40 years to pluck up the courage to do this, because I began thinking about making a return to Treasure Island the first time I read the book, which was when I was 18. I didn't read it as a child. And, of course, it is in some sense a children's book, but in other and all sorts of very interesting ways it rather isn't, I think. And the reason that it took me 40 years to pluck up the courage to do it was partly that I couldn't quite think how it might be done, but also because, and I dare say I'm speaking for Frank in saying this, it seems to me that the road to hell is paved with bad sequels and prequels, and that you need to be very, very careful before you venture down that path. They're bad by and large, or disappointing by and large, because they make an absolutely fundamental but understandable mistake, I think, which is to manifest their affection for the original thing by selling up too close to it, and simply trying to kind of take the story on in a very precise way. And in my way of thinking about things, rightly or wrongly, I eventually came to the conclusion that the only way of dealing with that problem was to take a giant step away from it before coming back to it again, in the way that Jean Rhys does in The Great White Sagacity, for instance, or that Tom Stoppard does in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, which has something very interesting to say about the Hamlet story, but is nevertheless a completely freestanding thing. And that's what I decided I should try and do.
Frank, what about you?
I mean, it's different because Treasure Island is a sublime work of genius, whereas Chitty Bang Bang is just quite a good idea, really, which was then turned into a film by Roald Dahl. And the difficulty is that what you remember, what you're talking about, is actually Roald Dahl's film of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and not at all Ian Fleming's book, which I bet you've never read.
No, I haven't. That was one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because I was reading an interview that you'd given somewhere else where you talked about the difference between the book and the film, and that the book was just this kind of greyer, blander thing.
Well, no, I'm not just dissing the book. The book has this brilliant idea of a car that flies, which is a fantastic idea. But Fleming meant to write a dozen Chitty Chitty Bang Bang books, and then the fags got him, you know, and he just died. So it was sort of waiting for a sequel.
And did you feel that you were writing after Fleming or after Dahl then?
I felt that I just had to do exactly what Andrew said and just dynamite the bridges and start again. So what I did was go back to the car, because there was a real car, which was really called Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. So I kind of told myself that Fleming had written a story based on this car, that Dahl had written a story, and that I was going to do one now. But it was the car, the real car, if there had been a real Treasure Island.
But Andrew, you do have recurring characters.
Well, we meet Mr. Silver, as he's rather respectfully become, now a colossally old man. We don't know exactly when Treasure Island was set. Stevenson just says 17 blank blank. But the Stevenson anoraks, of which there are many, reckon that it's early 1760s, and it's true that there are certain references made in the text that allow you to sort of work that out. And my response to the problem that we were talking about a minute ago of how to take a step away from it was to move it on a whole generation. So my book's The Other Side of the French Revolution, and it's the kids who go back, and they think they're children of light, and they're living in a completely different sort of universe where different rules apply, because the world has a different idea of democracy and of individuality and relationship to nature and so on and so forth, which is all sort of historically possible. But I wanted enough of a hinge between myself and the original book for there to be a sort of manifest connection, but not so much that I was sort of squeakily trying to, as I was saying at the outset, simply carry on the story in a narrow way. So we do meet Mr. Silver a couple of times. We meet his wife, who is referred to but never allowed to appear on a page in Treasure Island itself, and that's it. And there's the island, of course.
Yeah.
But they see the island in a very different way. Jim, my narrator, my Jim, sees the island in a very different way. Stevenson refers to dumb animals in a completely sort of way that's appropriate to the time that he's writing his book. But my narrator, Jim, too, who's 18, is a kind of beady-eyed little John Clare-like person who understands nature Well, he lives as a representative of a species among other species.
And we've mentioned the question of whether or not these books that you're writing after were children's books or not. And I mean, I think it's ambiguous in both cases, actually. But I wondered whether what you'd set out to create as sort of Carriers of the Flame was a children's book in both cases, or something more general than that.
I mean, I definitely decided to keep its age down, because one of the many things that attracted me about doing Chitty was that it had kind of inbuilt nostalgia. My ideal reader is a parent reading to a child, or, you know, an older sibling writing to a child, or whatever. But, you know, people sharing books. So the idea that something had nostalgia built into it that I didn't put there seemed like a fun thing to do. And a friend of mine is Russell Davis, who reinvented Doctor Who. And that whole thing of, like, it felt fresh as paint to my kids. But for me, there was even just the fact that it was Saturday night felt nostalgic, and I kind of wanted to cash in on that, but it had to be kiddie for that to work, you know. So I've probably taken its age down, if anything.
Yeah, but that's interesting. I like that idea of there's two layers of people reading it. There could be me reading it and thinking, God, this is just absolutely resonant, and my son hearing it and just.
But that's often done in a kind of bad faith way, in the kind of Shrek model where you put in, or the pantomime model where you put in jokes that are aimed at adults that you hope are going over the kids' head. And I hate that. I wanted to find something that would entertain both people. So it's got quite a lot about carburettors in it. You know, it didn't take much to infantilise a Top Gear watcher, I suppose.
No, not so much.
Well, I think I did rather the opposite thing and try and age it a bit. I've never written anything for children before, and I've always thought it was, from the outside, I've always thought that children's writers were, well, different. And that it wasn't something that most people could just sort of flick a switch and turn from being a children's writer into being an adult writer, or the other way around. My book is dedicated to somebody who was 11 when I started writing it, and I kept him in mind. He's now 14 or 15 or something. I don't have children that age myself. And as it happens, when my children were that age, they ran a mile before. They would rather run a mile before opening a book. What did I do to them? I think that I ended up feeling this just doesn't matter anymore. Anybody who is capable of enjoying this book, it's for them. And I just stopped thinking about it as either a kid's book or a grown-up's book. It's just a book. And if a 9-year-old were to read it and enjoy it, they would not get certain things in it, but they would enjoy certain other things. And if a 99-year-old person read it, they would get more of the references and so on. But I did want it to be serious. And if I can say that without sounding too solemn about it, I wanted to start with Treasure Island and end up with Out of Darkness, really.
Yeah, because it does, as well as being written after Stevenson, there's also an extent to which it seems to me it's written after William Golding and Conrad, as you
it
say.
It ends on, I mean, Treasure Island turns out to be rather like the island in Lord of the Flies. That was certainly in my mind, and actually there are quite a lot of buried references to Out of Darkness in it. I mean, actual quotations from Out of Darkness in the book, as well as a lot of references to Stevenson, and a little bit of Great Expectations, as if that weren't enough, because my idea of Natty, the Long John Silver's daughter, is that she's a bit like Estella. She's emotionally frozen because horrible things have happened to her.
You've both been immersed in these worlds that you've sort of entered into rather than just created. And I wondered whether, having written sequels, you could see yourselves writing sequels of sequels. Whether this is the end or you keep going with it.
Well, Chitty, Bang Bang, Fleming's book originally came out in 3 instalments. Very tiny instalments, I have to say. But with beautiful illustrations by John Birmingham. So this is going to be 3 installments. It's like it's one story in 3 installments. So that's that's always been part of the plan, that it would look like the original.
Yeah. Andrew, what about you?
Well, at the end of Silver, Natty and Jim, who are 18 years old, are washed up on the shores of what Stevenson calls Spanish America. And I'm next week going to sign the contract for the book that brings them back to England. And the plan is that in 3 years' time, I'll sign another contract.
Wow.
So I want there to be also 3. 3 is a good number for writers, I think. And God.
And Frank, finally, just one last question, if we may, on the penultimate day of the Olympics. Obviously, the other thing that you've been doing recently is script writing Danny Boyle's opening ceremony, and I just wondered,
which was based on another magical island.
Yeah. How you thought it had gone and how you felt about it now.
Well, it felt as though it went all right on the night. And then, because time after the opening ceremony always just seemed like an undiscovered, possibly imaginary country, I didn't have any plans for it, so we came up to Scotland and we haven't got a telly, and so I don't really know what's happened since, to be honest. Exactly. But we stayed in a hotel last night and gorged ourselves on what's left of the Olympics. So yeah, it was fun. It was great fun.
You're talking about magical islands. What was in your mind as an idea of Britain that you were trying to convey with this script?
I think we were all old enough to have discovered what I'm sure Andrew would say as well, because it comes from poetry, that the more specific you are, the more universal you are. And if we'd set out to try and describe a Britain, it would have been very bland and full of roughs. But we just talked about what we loved. And as it happens, there are enough people like us, which is the magic of poetry. And we used a lot of poetry in that opening ceremony. It's marinated in Blake and in Milton and bits of Ordner in there as well. So I think we took that from poetry.
Frank Cottrell Boyce and Andrew Motion. Silver is published by Jonathan Cape, and Frank's Chitty Chitty Bang Bang Flies Again by Macmillan. Meanwhile, another children's author, Julia Donaldson, was signing books for enthusiastic readers, and I think I saw a Gruffalo wandering around too. But the day has also been full of debate. John Ashton has been here to launch his book about the Lockerbie bombing with father of a victim, Jim Swire. And Paul Mason of the BBC's Newsnight has been joined by our Middle Eastern editor, Ian Black, to discuss 18 months of revolution. Paul's book is called Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, published by Verso. So what's he thinking about now?
The book is called Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, but the talks I've been doing are why it's still kicking off everywhere. Because we're 18 months in now to the events from the Arab Spring through to the European Spring, which, you know, the May, June events of 2011, the riots and mass protests in Greece and Spain, and then the Occupy movement, and then the Russian White Revolution. And that takes you through to 2012. And 2012 has been very interesting because a lot of the young people who probably pioneered this upsurge of dissent are feeling very down because it hasn't produced what they thought it would produce. But those of us who study social unrest and social movements are not surprised by that, because it produces something always less. As Orwell once said, always less than you gave. But it's not stopping. I mean, the Egyptian revolution obviously is the key thing in the Middle East. Even now, I would say, you have got this incredible rise of plebeian Islamism, so the Muslim Brotherhood, and then the much more fundamentalist Salafist movement. And of course, the secular liberal youth who made the revolution are almost disgusted with the outcome and disgusted with themselves in some ways for not being able to deal with or preempt the rise of this kind of plebeian radicalism with a very reactionary politics. But it's not over. The interesting thing that proves the point is Russia. Vladimir Putin, whatever you think about him, delivered an incredible economic growth and, for many people, economic improvement in their real lives. He went for re-election as president in the autumn of 2011 as a man who could say, it's better. It's better than it was politically, it's better than it was economically. And you would have expected the dissenting voices to remain a minority and a niche group. And instead, what you got is this most incredible rejection of Putin, both at the polls. I mean, we'll never know what the real result was. But on the streets. And so even in societies where relatively authoritarian or autocratic regimes are delivering to people, you've got this upsurge of a desire for freedom. And the Russian youth and the Russian people who went on the streets, it's very clear what they want. They want the right to live a Western-style, liberal lifestyle, with all that now means. And what you're seeing in Russia, and what I also think you're seeing in China, subcutaneously on the internet, is the demand of people for that basic thing, that basic substance, freedom, which has, of course, an immediate economic value to them. If one can form a small company without that company being immediately overtaken by some bureaucrat or some oligarch, and one can, you know, innovate without fear, you are living as near as you can get in modern society to a full, free human life. You know, the life that the dot-com entrepreneur lives on the west coast of America. That's what you want. That's the ideal. And even though some of the people who started these events are down in the dumps right now. I don't think it's over.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.